AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.com.
We're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. But where do you start? Unless you're a medical billing expert, finding savings can seem impossible. HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance and flags errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. Saving starts with knowing where to look. Visit HealthLock.com today before you see another healthcare provider.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, I'm your moon, you're my moon, we go round and round. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and our other host, Lauren Vogelbaum, is not with us today, but she will be back with us soon.
Yep.
She is off doing something awesome right now.
Yeah, she's vacating.
And we just have to sit here and talk about science that's going to blow your brains out your ears.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to specifically talk about one of my favorite things in science. And I really wanted to get some in here so that we could, you know, have that moment. Maybe we can have Noel pitch up our voices appropriately, because we're going to talk about helium.
Three!
Yeah, specifically Helium 3.
It's when you get to the third movie in the series, it almost always goes downhill, doesn't it?
It pretty much goes downhill after the second one.
How many can you think of where you get to the third one and it's still good?
It's still good? Yeah, that's a tough one, man. Maybe Evil Dead? Army of Darkness is pretty good.
That's a good one. Okay.
But it is very different, so.
But of course, Helium 3 is not actually a, what's the word for a sequel that's actually the third one? A triquel? It's not that. It's an isotope.
It is an isotope. So let's talk about what helium is, and then specifically what helium-3 is and why we're interested in talking about this in the first place.
Yeah, actually, because this is going to be more than just a chemistry lesson. It'll actually play into a discussion about technology that could be highly relevant to life on planet Earth and beyond.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So helium is an element.
Yeah, second lightest element in the universe behind hydrogen.
But it's always looking at hydrogen and saying, like, if only I were that thin.
It's, you know, hydrogen, it's just looking at hydrogen on the ladder, and it's like, you just watch yourself, buddy. I am one step behind, and if you falter, I will take your place. I might be anthropomorphizing elements a little bit, but no, it's a colorless, odorless, and tasteless element. It is a gas at room temperature. And it makes up a whopping 0.0005% of the Earth's atmosphere. And it's not gravitationally bound to the Earth. helium is so light that it just continues to float up and up and up until it can slip the earthly bonds of gravity and float out into space.
Yeah, and if you're like, wait a minute, how does that work? Just think about what happens to a helium balloon.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it, and it goes up. It's lighter than the atmosphere.
So, and eventually you've got the balloon that is, the balloon part is heavy enough to keep the whole thing floating off into space. That's why we don't have, you know, if you looked out into space, you wouldn't see the last, you know, 50 years of children's birthday party balloons circling right. the Earth. But,
no, I'm sure eventually the balloon pops.
Yes. But the gas itself can escape to space.
Yeah. So what makes an element that element? Well, it's the number of protons in the nucleus of the element. So the specific thing that makes helium helium is that it's got two protons.
Right.
Now, other things can vary.
Yes.
You can have like charged particles mm-hmm. or you can have charged atoms or you can have isotopes that have different numbers of neutrons.
Exactly.
The standard helium you're going to find on Earth, if you find it, because, again, it's pretty rare, is going to be helium-4.
Yeah, that's two protons, two neutrons. The four
it's
is
a nice balance.
It's referring to the mass here, really, the atomic mass. And
four total.
Yeah, four total. The two protons, the two neutrons. Helium-3, obviously, would mean that you'd have to have one fewer of those nucleic particles. But as you pointed out, Joe,
you can't change the number of protons.
No, if you did that, you would suddenly have tritium because you would have one proton, two neutrons. And well, actually, and you'd have to get rid of an electron. And that would end up being an isotope of hydrogen.
Right.
So if you have the only thing you can get rid of and still have it be helium is a neutron. So
right.
You get rid of a neutron. You have two protons, one neutron, and still two electrons. You've got helium-3. So yeah, if you have a surplus or a deficit of electrons, that's an ion of whatever, you know, element you're talking about. And then the different variations of neutrons, those are the isotopes.
Right. Okay, so I have a question though, Jonathan.
Sure.
You mentioned that it's not gravitationally bound to Earth. Well, obviously everything has a gravitational attraction, but I think what you're saying is that it's lighter than the atmosphere, so it just goes.
It just goes.
It just
and it
goes.
Boils off into space.
Right. So how come there's any on Earth at all?
That's a great question, because obviously if there were, you know, just some limited supply of helium by now throughout the Earth's history, you would have expected it all to go away. But
yeah.
In fact, helium can be the result of radioactive decay. So one of the things radioactive decay can produce are what are called alpha particles. That's specifically alpha decay.
And that's a form of ionizing radiation.
Right. And alpha particles are essentially a helium nucleus. So you've got the two protons and the two neutrons. And if it captures two electrons, it becomes a helium atom.
But that would be helium-4, like we talked about. Regular old helium that's got that nice nucleic balance.
Yeah. And that is by far the more prevalent type of helium that you would find on Earth. Like 99.2%. You know, some huge number percent of all the helium on Earth falls under the category of helium-4. Only a tiny percentage is helium-3.
Now, if I want to put helium to very good use, such as like buying a tank of it for a child's birthday party
right.
to fill up a bunch of balloons
yeah.
that eventually float up in the atmosphere, pop, fall down to Earth, and kill some wildlife, and then also just end up huffing some of it to make my voice really high.
Yeah.
Where does that helium come from? Like, where did they fill up the tank?
So, yeah, this is usually we get helium through as a byproduct of other things. So it's not that we've got, you know, we don't have people in the, you know, laboring away in the helium mines, you know, deep under the ground.
And that would be the most hilarious mine, though.
They would definitely be singing very high-pitched songs.
Hey, Carl.
And then when they emerge,
is your shift over yet?
When they emerge from the mines, you see these just enormous dudes. Now, it's mostly from natural gas deposits.
Oh, hold on a second. This is what happened to Snow White's Seven Dwarves, because they sing that song.
Yeah.
What is the song?
Which hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go.
Oh, I guess that's not all that high-pitched a song. For
no,
some reason, I was imagining
it's actually,
it was.
It's actually fairly low for, you know, it's hi-ho, hi-ho. Now, Snow White, she's going falsetto city. But anyway, getting back to this. It's mostly from natural gas deposits. And in the United States, we're talking about deposits that are mostly found in Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas. the state, not the band.
Right.
Yeah. So that's where we're getting it. Some other interesting facts about helium. You can liquefy helium. You can get it to turn into liquid form. In fact, that's very important for a lot of scientific purposes. But you got to get the temperature nice and chilly first.
I imagine it also requires applying some pressure.
It does. So if you're talking about turning helium into a liquid, it will be a liquid at minus 452 degrees Fahrenheit, which is minus 268.9 degrees Celsius.
That's cold, folks.
Yeah. So the freezing and boiling points of helium are lower than any other known substance. I mean, there may be other ones out there that we don't know of that could break this record, but so far, so good. And liquid helium is what what researchers and scientists are using to super cool elements at stuff like the Large Hadron Collider. You know, you want to make sure that superconductivity is something that normally we can only achieve through supercooling, as well as just removal of all electrical resistance. Resistance, that's where you lose energy in the form of heat.
Mm-hmm.
By supercooling, you can reduce resistance to zero. So you get electrons flowing through the conductor material. It becomes like a superconductor.
Yeah.
So
It's kind of like just turning whatever it is into a greased luge for electricity.
Yeah. Now, you know, we know about the main types of matter. You know, we'll discount plasma for the sake of conversation. But, you know, the three that all elementary school kids here in the U.S. learn about, you have the gases, you have the liquids, and then you've got the solids.
Mm-hmm.
So you might wonder, well, can you make helium into a solid? And the answer is you can, but it requires tremendous effort. Because you have to have it under a pressure of at least 25 atmospheres.
Oh, that may have been the pressure I was thinking about a minute ago.
Yeah, I mean, you would normally, if you're going to turn helium into a liquid here on Earth, you're going to be applying pressure anyway,
yeah.
Right? Because it's not – getting the temperature down that low is very difficult to do. The liquid helium is what you switch to when liquid nitrogen isn't cold enough. So – So you'd have to apply a pressure of 25 atmospheres and at a temperature of 1 Kelvin. 0 Kelvin, keep in mind, is no molecular movement. That's absolute zero. So that is minus 458 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 272 degrees Celsius. So pretty phenomenal stuff. And we were talking about the isotopes, the fact that, you know, that's the difference between, you know, how many protons or how many neutrons are in the nucleus of your atom.
Right. So the one you'd most often find on planet Earth is going to be your standard helium-4,
yep.
Two protons, two neutrons.
Yep.
We are going to be talking a lot more about helium-3. That's where you take one of the neutrons away.
Mm-hmm.
But how many isotopes are there total?
There are seven more than that, so there's 9 total.
Okay.
But there are only 2 that you're going to find in nature.
Right.
Helium-4 and helium-3, because those are the stable forms of helium. In the lab, you can make other isotopes, but they don't last forever. They decay.
In the lab, you can make all kinds of perversions of nature.
It's true. And in the lab, we just laugh and then, you know, and then there's the terror and the scariness and the right. Dinosaurs get loose and
some helium atoms wake you up in the middle of the night saying, "Why did you create me ugly?
It's time." Lots of different isotopes. Only 2 are found in nature. So it's exactly the same 2 that we've been talking about all this time. And now there were a pair of scientists who were the first to propose that the isotope helium-3 would exist. That would be Mark Oliphant, who was an Australian physicist,
mm-hmm.
and Ernest Rutherford, who was a New Zealand physicist. So I have to imagine that they worked together, that they fought like cats and dogs, because those Australians and New Zealanders, let me tell you. Actually, they're both very nice. Just don't confuse one for the other.
Right.
That's the rule of thumb. But they were investigating the possibilities of helium and hydrogen isotopes way back in the 1930s, and they discovered tritium, which is hydrogen with a mass of 3, so it's a proton and 2 neutrons.
Okay.
And they also discovered helium-3, which is helium with a mass of 3. So 3 was an interesting number for them.
It's all right. The magic number.
So we've known about helium-3 since the 1930s. And the question now is, why on earth did we pick helium-3 to talk about here on this podcast?
Yeah, I mean, there are tons of isotopes that most of them just, what do they matter? What can you do with them?
Yeah, the interesting thing about helium-3 is it's potentially a very useful source of fuel for nuclear fusion. as in a nuclear reactor that uses fusion, not fission, to generate electricity.
Hold on a second.
Yeah.
I thought nuclear fusion was just one of those wacko dreams.
It may still be. We're hoping that it won't be, but it's one of those things where the science is saying something, and now we're waiting for the technology to catch up.
Okay, well, let's do a real quick and easy distinction between nuclear fission and nuclear fusion.
Right.
Nuclear fission are all the nuclear power plants we've got today.
Yeah, these are the nuclear power plants that we've talked about in previous episodes of Forward Thinking. These are the ones that are generating nuclear waste. That's
right.
One of the big problems with these facilities. They rely on uranium. They rely on uranium decay. Essentially, it's to create a nuclear reaction that becomes self-sustaining.
Right. So you take a piece of uranium and you get it nice and enriched so that it is primed to have a runaway reaction of sending off radiation particles.
Yeah.
And then you set it going.
Right. And it keeps itself going, so you don't have to continuously pour energy in to maintain that reaction.
So how does that turn into electricity?
Well, it generates a lot of heat. Mm-hmm. That heat ends up converting water into steam. So you're using water to help manage the temperature of this nuclear reactor. And it's also being turned into steam. The steam ends up turning steam turbines. And then ends up being recycled back into the system, like the steam condenses into water and is used to cool it again.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have a paired cooling system where you've got the coolant, the actual water that's cooling the core is not the same water that's going through the turbine system. I mean, you can pair it that way. So essentially you have two pipes next to each other. One pipe is the steam that's been generated from direct contact with the nuclear material. And the other pipe is a closed system of water that then gets converted into steam because of the heat from the first pipe. But in either case, you're talking about creating steam. It turns a turbine. The turbine generates electricity. And that's where we get electricity from nuclear power plants.
Right. Okay. So fission is taking big chunks of elements that are very heavy atoms and breaking them apart into little pieces to create heat that we translate to electricity. Fusion is taking very small atoms and gluing them together. And that's also an energetic reaction. It also produces energy when that fusion between the atomic nuclei occur.
Right. And it's creating energy in a different way.
Yeah.
So if you think about how, it actually makes a lot of sense. If you take a big heavy atom and you break it apart and you get energy in the form of heat, then in order to fuse two atoms together, you need heat.
Right.
You need to pour energy into the system to make them combine together. As a result, they will eject other particles. Now, in nuclear fission, some of those particles include things like neutrons that can cause real issues if you don't have a containment system for them. In fusion, you're talking mainly about protons. Protons are easier to control, and I'll get to that in a second. So the other big difference is that you're not turning water into steam with nuclear fusion plants. You actually get a net electrical energy from this fusion. So it's like imagine that the fusion reactor has a big outlet and you just plug your thing into that and it would be generating the electricity running the thing. Except,
wow.
Of course, it obviously doesn't work exactly like that.
But you are saying direct electricity generation. It generates a pressure of electrons that will flow into an electrical grid.
Well, and it's a little more complicated than that. You have to look at an electromagnet system, which is specifically used to help control the protons that get ejected in this process. And that's partly where you're starting to get some electrical output. But yes, ultimately, there's no conversion of water into steam in this scenario. It's not, unlike almost every other version of electricity we've talked about, with possible exceptions like solar energy, it doesn't involve converting water into steam to turn a turbine.
Right.
It is in itself a means of generating electricity.
Now, the old methods that I've heard, when people used to talk years ago about creating fusion, what I always heard for fusion power plants was that it would involve harvesting deuterium from the ocean. Tritium and deuterium, I believe.
Yeah.
And those are also different isotopes of elements, but those are isotopes of the element hydrogen.
Right. Deuterium is a hydrogen atom that has a proton and a neutron. And
it's also called heavy hydrogen.
Yep. And tritium is extremely heavy hydrogen, dude, because it's a proton and two neutrons. So, yeah, exactly. Those were the ways that we had thought about before. Now, obviously, the other thing we should point out really quickly is fusion, that's the same energy that we see in stars.
Right. And typically what you hear is happening inside a star. I'm sure it's actually, you know, a star specialist could tell you that more is going on. But the basic process is hydrogen fusing into helium.
At a temperature of millions of degrees.
Right.
Right. Because, you know, They Might Be Giants taught us.
Yeah.
Actually, they were covering a song from an old kids album. But that's beside the point. Exactly, though. And so the deuterium and tritium, the idea was that you could take these isotopes of hydrogen and fuse them together, and you would end up with helium as one of your byproducts, but you would also end up getting neutrons that would be bounced off from this fusing process. And those neutrons are hard to control as opposed to protons. And the reason why is that neutrons have no charge, right? So
yeah.
Imagine that you've got a material that has no magnetic charge to it.
Yeah.
And think of it like a ceramic ball, okay? So there's no magnetic activity here. It's a ceramic ball, and it's a big one. Let's say it's the size of a van, and it's rolling down a hill at you. You got to get out of the way of that ceramic ball. That's all there is to it. Now let's say that instead of it being a ceramic ball, it's something that can have a charge to it, and it's rolling down a hill at you. But you have a really powerful electromagnet that you have set to the opposite charge of that giant thing that's rolling towards you, and you flip a switch. Those opposite charges attract one another, and it will slow or even stop that charged ball from coming down and crushing you.
Yeah. Another way to think of it is that protons are sticky and neutrons are not.
Yeah.
And if you have the right kind of sticky flypaper to attract some protons, you can catch them more easily than you catch neutrons.
And obviously, if you want to control the movement of particles that are going really, really super fast, you have to pour energy into the system in order to do that. With neutrons, that ends up becoming a big problem. It's one of the reasons why, one of the many reasons why, nuclear fusion reactions have been difficult to sustain, where you get a reaction that's greater than the amount of energy you poured into the system in the first place.
Okay, so we're talking about the difference between fusion reactions that produce protons versus fusion reactions that produce fast-moving neutrons. But how is that relevant to helium-3?
So
what's the difference?
Using helium-3 as a fuel in fusion gets you around the neutron problem depending upon what you pair it with.
Okay, so you're saying if we go with the idea of tritium and deuterium fusion, that's more likely to produce these fast neutrons.
Right. And if you use helium-3 and deuterium, then the fusion between those two would result in helium-4 atom and an extra proton. But that's easier, again, to contain because the proton has a charge. So you can use an electromagnet that has a negative charge because protons have positive charge, and be able to attract it that way and stop it from, you know, being such a being akin to a fast-moving neutron. And so you would have a really efficient system that way, and it doesn't generate nuclear waste. But you could also fuse helium-3 with itself. So instead of helium-3 and deuterium being merged together, you merge two helium-3 atoms together, and that would produce helium and two protons. But either way, this approach, you don't end up with an unstable isotope that leads to decay, which would be another way of saying you don't have radioactivity.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so now that we know this, let's just gather up tons and tons of helium-3 from those natural gas reserves and make a fusion reactor that will provide abundant, clean energy without producing nuclear waste. Well, that seems like an easy win. Why aren't we doing that right now?
Hold on, Slick. So the main reason is that, again, helium-4 is overwhelmingly the type of helium we have here on Earth. To the point where getting helium-3, there's so little helium-3 in the United States that it'll blow your mind. So let's say that, you know, you wanted to have enough helium-3 to provide electricity to the United States for an entire year. You would need about 25 tons more, give or take, of helium-3.
Oh, that's easy. The Earth's big.
Yeah. Right now we got 25 kilograms of helium-3 in the United States. There's a large gap, you might notice, between what we need and what we have.
Ah.
And it's because...
That sounds more precious than silver or gold.
Yeah. And we don't have any means of generating more of it in a way that would be less problematic. For example, here's one way we could generate helium-3.
You mean just make it in the lab?
Kind of, if you think of a lab as a nuclear fission reactor.
Nice.
So let's say you're using a heavy water nuclear reactor. Heavy water nuclear reactors, you have deuterium inside of them, and tritium inside of them, inside the water itself.
Oh, wait. So you're saying, like, the water is H2O, but that H in the water, instead of being standard hydrogen, which is just a proton and an electron, the H in the H2O is actually heavy H.
Yeah,
heavy
and it
hydrogen.
Really would be tritium, not deuterium. I should have – I think I kind of misspoke earlier. But at any rate, you could generate tritium this way, even if it was just deuterium. You could generate tritium in this way, and then you would have to store the tritium in giant tanks to – start to decay and undergo decay. When if they undergo decay, then one of the things they generate is helium-3. Mm-hmm. But that would take like 12 years for it to decay to any appreciable amount, give or take 8 days. So 12 years is a long time to wait to, you know, and plus that whole time you're generating nuclear waste because you're using nuclear fission, not fusion. So we could do that here on Earth, but it seems like that would be a problematic means of generating helium.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that is another issue. We don't have a lot of it here on Earth. Making more of it here on Earth is not an ideal solution. So maybe we need to look somewhere else.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
Now, earlier, we were talking about how the fusion process inside stars works by fusing hydrogen atoms into helium.
Yeah, we
and
did
it's
say
got
that.
It's got a net helium output. Mm-hmm. So over time, more of the mass of a star is going to be made up of helium. But a star also ejects particles.
Yes.
So particles are, you know, you have this solar wind and radiation pressure, mm-hmm. and all this stuff coming off of the sun all the time. Part of what's coming off of the sun is particles from the sun.
Right.
Being blown out into space. I bet a lot of that is helium-3, isn't it?
Yeah. There's a significant amount of helium-3 being given off by the sun. And if only we didn't have this pesky atmosphere, it would make its way here to Earth. But our atmosphere pretty much... You know, the helium-3 is not going to enter Earth's atmosphere. It's just not. But
wait a second. I know a particular moon that doesn't have an atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's the moon.
Yeah, that one. The moon.
One of the best moons.
No, well, it's my favorite moon. So the moon does not have an atmosphere. So helium-3 from solar wind will impact the moon, and actually the lunar soil absorbs helium-3. So there is helium-3 locked away in the lunar regolith, which that's that top
the,
soil
the
above.
Loose dust
yeah.
on the moon.
And rocks as well. I mean, you know, but yeah, there's helium-3 in them thar craters. So that is a potential source for helium-3.
It's amazing to think about how on the moon, despite the kind of like bigness and scariness and violence of space,
mm-hmm.
nothing happens on the moon. You know, except unless there's the occasional impact from some rock or something like that. There's no weather. There's no wind blowing things.
There's a Chinese rover rolling around up there right now.
Pretty much nothing happens. So it's just been up there for billions of years, slowly accumulating the dust that we could go and harvest to use in our fusion reactors.
Yeah, 1 million tons of helium-3. So remember
how much
I said
did you say we
25
needed?
Tons would provide enough for energy for the entire United States for a year.
Well, that's pretty good.
So a million tons would – that would give us our – assuming that we could get nuclear fusion to work out. That's the base
the
assumption
factor
that we have to keep in mind. But assuming we get that to work out – And assuming we could find some way of harvesting this helium-3 from the moon, we would have a potential energy source for thousands of years. So the other thought is that you hope, at least, that humans of the future would continue to look at different ways of generating energy or capturing energy and generating electricity that didn't even involve fusion, and that by the time we would ever get to a point where we're like, well, moon's looking a little scrawny, it wouldn't
hopefully
matter.
By then we'll have a Dyson sphere that just captures all of the energy of the sun.
A boy can dream.
But okay, so we need to remember one thing that you said a minute ago. I think it's good to keep in mind. You make it sound like this is not the only stumbling block to achieving fusion power.
No.
Like we still also have to figure out how to have an optimal reactor design and how to initiate reactions that are going to give us more energy than we put in.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a significant part of the problem, right?
Yes, this would be
the helium-3.
The helium-3 would be a huge solution to some very difficult problems, assuming we could get the reactor part to work. So,
okay,
you know, that part has to work too. But yeah, assuming that has to work, helium-3 would be a huge, huge bonus, as opposed to using deuterium and tritium.
Well, let's play that imagination game. Let's say we've got a team here who they say, all right.
Top men.
Yeah.
Yeah. And women.
And
women. But, I mean, I'm just quoting Raiders.
And I'm sure some dogs, too. And
sure. Yeah.
By then, we'll have genetically engineered really smart dogs.
Maybe they'll be deuterium-sniffing dogs. Who knows?
Anyway.
Okay.
A team of wonderful, brilliant organisms.
Yes.
Will say, hey, we've got a fusion reactor that can get the job done. You just got to get us enough helium-3.
Yeah.
And we know there's a bunch on the moon.
Yeah.
What does that operation look like? How do we get our hands on it? How do we get it to the reactors and turn that into a manageable electricity-producing system?
Well, if we get to the point where the fusion reactors are making sense, it'll be a race to get that helium-3 off the moon. Because there is absolutely no reason to not pursue it at that point unless you come to the conclusion that the effort to get it is costing you more energy than what you're getting out of using, which seems unrealistic, assuming that we're able to transport a significant amount of helium-3 back to Earth. It wouldn't be a big, you know, I could imagine that being something, you know, possible. So let's put this into perspective. The amount of helium-3 on the moon, or that's estimated to be on the moon, is more than has more energy stored in that potential energy stored there than 10 times all the coal, all the natural gas, and all the oil that the Earth has ever had.
Wow.
More than 10 times. So think about that being a tempting target. You're like, obviously, we have to go after that, assuming we can get the reactor part to work. So, all right, so keeping that in mind, that we have to have something to meet our energy needs. We want it to be clean. We don't want to produce radioactivity. This is like no carbon footprint deal. This is fantastic. What does it take to get there? Well, obviously, it takes a system that would allow us to send missions from Earth to the moon to capture helium-3, to then bring that helium-3 back to Earth. So what might that look like? In the 90s, there was a proposal about a possible future mining system that was beautiful in its insanity. they suggest.
Let me guess. The actual fusion power plant is on the moon, and they send the energy it produces back to Earth via a giant laser.
Only slightly less crazy than that.
Moon laser.
Only slightly less crazy. So, okay. Well, you do get a moon laser.
Oh, okay.
Don't get ahead of me. All right. So imagine that you've got this rover. And when I say rover, I'm not talking about a tiny rover crawling across the moon. I'm not even talking about something as relatively large as the Curiosity rover, which is pretty big, actually. I'm talking something gargantuan. Like, imagine the biggest piece of construction material, you know, like construction vehicles you've ever seen, and make that bigger, because that's what I'm talking about. This is, you know, if you've ever seen the vehicle that pulls the space shuttle to its launch pad, that's kind of the size we're talking about here. And this design, which, by the way, they just had a computer graphics kind of, you know, this is a proof of concept sort of thing. It had a wheel on the front of it that would scoop up regolith up to 2 meters down from the surface of the moon. So, you know, that's a big scoop, right? It pulls it into the machine, and the machine has a series of vibrating screens that separate the rocks from the dust. Now, the rocks are too big to efficiently treat to get the helium-3 out. So they get dumped back onto the surface of the moon. The dust keeps getting separated into smaller and smaller grains. So anything that's larger than 100 microns in size gets dumped back on the moon. All the grains that are 100 microns in size or smaller get put into a heating chamber. Now, in order to separate the helium-3 from this lunar soil, you have to apply heat, and a lot of it, like in excess of 600 degrees Celsius.
Is this where the laser comes in?
This is where the laser comes in.
Nice.
So their design also had an enormous satellite dish-like thing on the top.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a mirrored array. So you point it toward the sun. It captures sunlight, concentrates that sunlight into a very tight beam, similar to a laser. So when I said it is a laser, I'm kind of exaggerating a bit, but concentrates into a beam of very hot solar energy that is then directed to a series of pipes that contain liquefied metal that heat up. The liquefied metal provide the heat to the regolith, the little fine grains of moon dust that get pushed through this heating chamber. That releases a lot of the stuff that happens to be fused with that lunar soil. And it's not just helium-3. That's one of the things that is attached to it. But also you've got stuff like water, you've got carbon dioxide, you've got methane. There's all these other like tiny molecules of the stuff are married to this dust.
Yeah, and if you're like, who cares? Well, it matters on the moon.
Yeah, if you wanted to have an operation on the moon where you know, we haven't really talked about what would be required on the moon itself to make this happen. Most of the proposals I see suggest that eventually you would have some sort of lunar base.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a lunar base, then if it's a lunar base that has humans in it, you're going to need stuff in order to provide water, oxygen, you know, all these other sort of things, fuel, things that are really important in order to maintain a presence there. Also, I've seen proposals saying that, okay, maybe we don't even have a lunar base there. Maybe everything that's on the moon is operated autonomously by robots and that there are no humans there. But you could still end up using a lot of those materials for things like missions to Mars or other destinations. So,
yeah. Well, we've talked many times here on how having water in space is useful in so many ways.
Yeah. So
even if just for the fact that you're not having to ship it up there in a, you know, rocket where it costs so much money.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so you would get access to this stuff. You would also be able to rest assured that you're not creating giant pits, like mining pits on the moon. It would essentially look like it would definitely make the moon look different. Craters, small craters would get smoothed out. So the surface of the moon would actually change in appearance over time. But, I mean, it all depends on what side of the moon the operation is on. Keep in mind, there's no dark side of the moon, at least not a permanent one. There's a night side of the moon. And, in fact, the night becomes important because you've got all these different gases contained in a part of this rover, right? And you need to get to the helium-3. So how do you get the helium-3 separated from everything else? The night cycle could actually help you in that endeavor in separating out the different gases, right? So you've got them all contained in this chamber. But one of the things we pointed out, helium, very, very low liquefying point as far as temperatures go. It gets really cold on the lunar night cycle, which lasts a long time compared to Earth. It's not a day.
So this plan may be pretty high on the insanity meter, but it's also pretty clever.
Yeah, it's taking advantage of physics to say, like, well, by having the rover harvest in the daytime, right, and convert into the helium-3 during the daytime, the lunar daytime, which lasts like 15 days, and then go into the night cycle, that low temperature is going to liquefy nearly all the gases besides helium and hydrogen, which you can then vent into a different chamber and then separate those out later. And there are ways of separating helium from hydrogen. So you could do that, and then the liquefied stuff you could separate in other ways and use it for whatever it is you need to use it. So that was really pretty interesting.
So that was the old plan, though.
Yeah.
And
one that was never put into place.
Yeah. That was the old plan. And I think just us talking about this in the very sketchiest way makes it pretty clear that this would be an enormous investment required to actually set up like a lunar mining operation of any kind.
Yeah, we don't even have the type of vehicles that would be necessary to land on the lunar surface to be loaded up with this stuff and return back to Earth. Like this, you know, they were talking about in the video that a vehicle similar to the space shuttle would be able to carry the amount we would need to fuel the Earth, the United States energy needs for a full year. But we don't have anything like that right now. Mm-hmm. The space shuttle alone obviously would not have been able to do it because it was not designed to leave low Earth orbit. So we would need to have a type of spacecraft capable of making a journey to Earth and bringing back a substantial amount of helium-3, or if you didn't do this the way that was suggested in that video back from the 1990s, you'd be bringing back lunar soil, and that's that's heavier, right? You're talking about bringing back a larger amount of material for a smaller amount of the stuff you actually want. Because most of that mass is going to be made up of the soil, not of the helium-3 that you actually want to get. Whereas the proposed version that I said from the 90s, they'd be getting just the helium-3 or whatever, you know, other fuels or whatever sent back. And you would leave the soil on the moon. There has been a proposal. In fact, there is an ongoing series of missions that is looking at the possibility of using the moon as a source for various stuff, including helium-3, and it comes from China.
Ah.
So, I don't know. Have you read about the Chang'e lunar lander?
I don't think I have, or if I have, I forgot the name.
So this was the lunar lander that touched down last year on the surface of the moon.
Oh, okay.
So So China's the third nation to have successfully done a soft landing on the moon. And the lander also has a rover called the U2 rover. And the purpose of that mission was really just to do scientific measurements of the soil on the moon, as well as, you know, some other scientific research. But there's going to be a future mission that takes advantage of what was learned on this one, and it is called the Chang'e 5 mission. That's scheduled to happen sometime in 2017, if everything stays on schedule. And its mission is a little different. It's to travel to the moon, land on the moon, dig up a certain amount of lunar soil, 2 kilograms of it, and then blast off to end up meeting back up with a lunar orbiter, so it's similar to the way the Apollo missions worked, and then return to Earth. So it would actually be bringing lunar soil back to Earth. This is obviously not ideal because, again, you're having to carry a lot more material, and ultimately the stuff you are interested in is just a fraction of that material. But it is an actual step toward this proposal of using the moon as a source of mining material. So, I mean, it's while you could argue it's not efficient, and that even if this all works, that it ultimately wouldn't make sense from an energy production perspective, what you have to say is it's happening, right?
Yeah.
Like whether this particular version is something that would ultimately be used on a larger scale is kind of immaterial. It's really to say someone has fired the first shot in a new space race.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least
to mix metaphors.
At least it could probably teach us. I believe you said earlier that the amount of helium-3 in the lunar soil, we've got a pretty good estimate, we think, of how much is in there, but we don't know for sure yet.
No, we don't know for sure, and also the concentration within a given amount of lunar soil
could vary.
Could vary, and yeah. It's not as much. Like, yes, there may be a million tons of helium-3 in the lunar soil. This particular thing is bringing back 2 kilograms of lunar soil. And when we talk about the helium-3 being in there, obviously that's, you know, depending upon the concentration, it's going to be a pretty small amount of helium-3.
Yeah.
So, again, you might say, well, that doesn't seem very practical, but it's a step. Mm-hmm. It's you can't think of it as this is an ends to itself. No, this is a step on a journey to use the moon as a source of material for energy or whatever. Because, you know, you could use it for other things if you wanted to. If you wanted to mine it for water, you could. So the question I have is whether or not this is going to start a new flurry of activity among various nations to look at the moon seriously as a potential source for energy fuel. And if it does, what that might mean in the next 5 to 10 years, where various entities will be trying to lay claim to that. Will we get to a point where those treaties that were signed in the past need to be revisited because we're now viewing the moon as an actual legitimate source of fuel? Then how do we fairly designate that as such, right?
You're talking about, like, if people can, because we've sort of had an agreement that, you can't harvest resources from planets and say that they belong to you.
Right. You can't
claim.
You maybe can
from, like, asteroids, because that's not considered, what is it, a fixed body or something?
Yeah. I mean,
I remember
essentially,
some weird
essentially
stuff.
It's not supposed to be a celestial body, but I think in most people would argue that you could probably get away with mining stuff. You couldn't claim the entire body as belonging to China. Like, you couldn't say this now is the Great People's Republic of China Lunar Division.
That would stop us.
Yeah, you weren't supposed to be able to do that. So what we're looking at is the possibility of that being, you know, adjusted over time. If we've got lots of different interested parties all wanting to go to the moon and using different means, it also could mean that our moon would look very different in another, like, 20 years. So, I mean, none of this is set in stone, obviously. I mean, if the nuclear fusion thing never works out, then it's pointless anyway. No one's going to do it. But,
well, I don't know if I'd say it's pointless, because we've talked about this with several other things in space exploration, where you might have a mission to discover a particular answer to a question or to exploit a particular resource. And even if that doesn't pan out, space exploration is all symbiotic. Like, every mission makes every next mission easier and more possible.
Well, yeah. I mean, the missions themselves would certainly lead to advances in science and technology that would be beneficial to us. What I really meant was that the goal, assuming that the goal of the mission is to create a sort, or to get to a source of fuel for fusion. If the fusion doesn't work out, then that mission, part of the mission, doesn't make sense. Doesn't mean that we don't benefit in other ways.
Right.
But that particular part of the mission becomes moot.
Right. Well, I hope they can exploit helium-3 and make fusion work, obviously. I mean, that would be a revolutionary thing for energy on Earth. But
and
I also just hope they build a lunar base.
Well, so do I. I mean, there was a few years ago, NASA was trying to get excitement about the potential for a lunar base again. I remember we even had here at How Stuff Works, though not here in this building, at our old building, we had someone from NASA come in and give a presentation about a proposed lunar base. This was a few years ago when NASA was really kind of pushing for that. But then, you know, budgets changed, things changed, and that plan got put on the back burner. But there's always the hope that if this, in fact, looks like it's a promising route, that will encourage the funding of such missions and not just a reliance upon private companies here in the United States. I mean, that could definitely help as well, or it could lead to what we saw in Moon, because that's the plot of Moon. The main character in Moon is overseeing a helium-3 mining operation on the moon.
Jonathan, don't scare the children.
But do go see Moon, because that's a good movie.
That is a great movie.
It is really good. It's a good science fiction
movie. One of the best science fiction movies of the past 10 years.
Yeah. So, the optimist in me certainly hopes that fusion works out, because it would be enormous. I mean, being able to shrug off our dependence on fossil fuels for the majority of our energy needs would be phenomenal for so many reasons. I mean, from a national security standpoint, it would be wonderful. Although, again, this could raise serious questions about national security for other nations. What happens to nations that don't have the capability of sending mining operations to the moon? Are they going to rely upon some sort of weird helium-3 market, which I imagine that's exactly what would happen? Would they have to... You know, I mean, would there be this crazy divide between nations that have access to fusion technology and those that don't? Probably, at least for a while, there would be. But I hope that these sort of things could be ironed out over time, and that we could get our dependence away from fossil fuels, and that could in turn lead to at least a diminishing of the effects of climate change. We know that climate change is going to continue to happen, and really at this point what we need to do is see how drastically we can reduce those effects. Mm-hmm. And this would go a really long way to helping that happen, particularly when you think China's leading the way here.
Yeah.
That's enormous, right? So big hope that it all pans out. I mean, there are a lot of ifs, but I don't see any of them as being pessimistic. Like, I don't think any of them are there's not enough indicators there to tell me that this is just totally crazy. It's like this is the long shot of long shots. And if it works out, it's great. And if it doesn't work out, no one is surprised. I think that there's a much greater chance of this working out than that. At least I hope so.
Me too.
But yeah, this was kind of fun to talk about. We did not get balloons to celebrate this particular episode because we're generally of the opinion that helium should be used for really important things besides our entertainment. Or at least I am. And so we didn't do that. However, big surprise, we're going to go and enjoy some nice frosty coffee-based beverages in just a moment. So, because we're going to go talk about some episodes of Forward Thinking video series with our director and editor shortly. The little peek behind the curtain. We're actually going to be talking about what's coming up in the future of the show. So if you guys haven't checked out the video series for Forward Thinking, you should definitely go do that. It's a lot of fun. Joe and I both work on it. I host it. Joe writes a lot of the episodes. I write some of the other episodes. Lauren writes some of the episodes. Mm-hmm. And we explore all sorts of topics. And those videos are great. So if you haven't checked those out, do so. If you have any suggestions for future topics, you should write in to us. We love getting your messages. We've been getting a ton of them, and it really helps us choose which topics we're going to cover. We've had a few people talk about fusion and helium-3 in the past, so I'm glad we're able to talk about this. But you should send us an email. That address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Google+. At Twitter and Google+, we are fwthinking. At Facebook, just search fwthinking in the search bar. We will pop right up, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
There are choices that can change your life.
Like the choice to start routine colorectal cancer screening at age 45.
It's one of the most common cancers for women and men, and it doesn't always have symptoms.
But there's good news. Routine screening can catch colorectal cancer early and even prevent it.
And there's even better news. You have screening options.
Make the choice to put your health first. Talk to your doctor about your screening options or visit cdc.gov/screenforlife for more information.